Georgia poet laureate Judson Mitchum is also a successful fiction writer, drawing on his Southern working-class childhood and his 30 years as a white man at a predominantly black college. He depicts stories that intertwine black and white Georgia families in different decades, dealing with race, class, friendship, and family.
Saul Bellow calls fiction the higher autobiography, and I think that's what you try to do. It seems to be my subject and my privilege to be dealing with that particular complicated set of experiences.
Judson Mitchum reads from his novels today on New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam. Born and raised in Monroe, Georgia, Judson Mitchum taught laboratory psychology for 3 decades at Fort Valley State University. He retired to focus on his writing and the teaching of that craft around his state, most recently at Mercer and Emory Universities. He has served as the Poet Laureate of Georgia since 2012, so when WUGA-FM invited me to do a public interview for National Poetry Month, Judson Mitchum, a graduate of the University of Georgia, was the obvious choice, especially since his first poetry book, Somewhere in Ecclesiastes, was published in 1991 by the University of Missouri. That book brought him his first Georgia Author of the Year award. His second came in 1996 for his first novel, The Sweet Everlasting, which also won Georgia's Townsend Prize for fiction. He won the Townsend Prize again in 2006 for his second novel, Sabbath Creek. After the publication of A Little Salvation, Poems Old and New, he was inducted into the Georgia Writers Hall of Fame in 2013. An earlier New Letters on the Air features his poetry, so this second part of the conversation, recorded by WUGA in front of an audience at the Indigo Hotel in Athens, Georgia, focuses on his fiction that incorporates parts of his life, including his father's work in Monroe's cotton mill, where Judson Mitchum worked summers.
One of the things that I learned from Jim Kilgo, a wonderful writer who was my friend who taught at the University of Georgia, and he said, well, if you're writing a novel, you have to have some work, some employment that is central to it, that you know well, because work is central to people's lives. And I thought, well, what do I know? And cotton mill work is one thing that I knew, at least at a superficial level. I knew the people of the mill town. And so I observed that. My mother's people were also tenant farmers. And so that's the world I know. I've never done any real work myself. I've worked in the university all my life. And I do consider it serious work. But it's not loading trucks, and it's not working on a spinning frame, and it's not hauling things off of a cloth dock. It's a different kind of work. But I felt a need to ground things in work and to write about something that I knew.
Well, speaking of that, let's start with your novel, The Sweet Everlasting, which is a wonderful book. And this sets up the main character, the protagonist in this novel, talking about work.
My main character is working in a cotton mill, and he's doing a menial job, and he wants to be a loom fixer. And a loom fixer was a good job in the cotton mill. On the floor where the looms were, the weave floor, there would be, as I recall, something like 300 looms that would all be running and would be very loud. One of the characters I'm talking about here is based upon my Uncle Woodrow, who was a loom fixer in Monroe Mills. This voice is the voice of a rural white man, and it's an uneducated voice, and I have to say that it was the discovery that I could write in this voice that allowed me to write this book, enabled me to narrow the diction and just to tell the story.
How did this voice first come to you? I mean, was it in a dream? There's a lot of dreaming in your books and your poetry. Did this come to you that way?
No, the voice didn't come to me that way. There's so much trial and error in what I do, and so much that I have to throw out. I was writing in this voice from the first when I was writing this character, but I was also writing in another voice, a smarter voice, a voice with which I thought I would demonstrate my intelligence. And so I had a third-person omniscient narrator weaving in and out of this voice. And I got a lot of pages into it and realized, well, one of these voices is interesting, and one of them is not. And the voice that was trying to be so smart was not. The other voice was much smarter. And so I decided to go with a voice that entertained me, and it was that voice. Now, that voice was not something that I ever had to work on. I grew up in a family where we did voices of other people. I've been an obnoxious mimic all my life. And don't do it so much anymore because I realized how obnoxious it can be. But it is a source of joy to be able to capture a voice like that. And there were several voices of this nature that are in that book, some of them that you're more able to listen to than others because of the attitudes that they have. But the Southern accent is my accent, and I just have to torque it up a little bit and change the syntax and the grammar a little bit to make that voice.
I don't know how many of you have read The Sweet Everlasting, but when I first marked it, I just liked this passage about his ambition and a little bit about his relationship to Susan, his wife. But as I ended the whole novel and I thought about this passage, the foreshadowing and just how deftly you did that, I'm going to get you to read from here to the end of that chapter.
This is my character talking about his work. They had deaf folks all over the weave shop. You'd hear them yelling at each other outside on their break. From the first week, I had my eyes set on a job as a loom fixer, the best-paying job in the mill, short of being a shift boss. Everybody knew the loom fixers could get jobs anywhere there was a cotton mill. Can't everybody learn it, they said. Don't get me wrong. I didn't have no problem with hauling bobbins. It was honest work. But I knew I could probably get me some machines to run or fix, and then I'd get paid better, and maybe my back wouldn't hurt so bad. Turned out you had to practically know the governor to get trained as a loom fixer. When I went up and asked the shift boss about it, he laughed at me and waved a man over and shouted to him. They both laughed. I asked him what was so damn funny, and the shift boss said, "Boy, you don't know nothing." He pointed out across the floor, "Take a look at the folks working them looms. Lots of them wants to be loom fixers, and they can't, and they know what a loom by God is. You ain't hardly ever seen one." They looked at each other and laughed, and right then was when I made up my mind I'd be a loom fixer. After my shift was done, I'd hang around and watch, mostly Jamie Phillips, about the oldest loom fixer there, and he never minded it. Didn't say much, though, so I had to look real close. And he was so deaf that I did shout a question to him. He might not even know it. I watched him for about 2 months. And then one day somebody was out, and they didn't have nobody else, and they pulled me off bobbins to try to help out. I guess I done all right. And then when this man on the third shift broke his neck driving drunk, instead of training somebody new, they put me on. Third shift was hard. I couldn't get my sleep right. And I blew up at Susan a few times about nothing, which she didn't take kindly to say the least. She had a temper herself. Said she didn't need no man, would do fine on her own. Said if I thought I could even begin to speak to her any way I wanted to, she'd be more than happy to pack up her things and let me have my precious life all to myself. And one more thing, she said. When she was gone, she was gone. None of this coming and going for her. End of the line, as far as she was concerned. Now, I myself have never been one to push folks around, but then I never much cared to be around folks I knew I could do it to, either. Susan was pretty much the same way, and so we always had a lot of fights. But we got used to it, even laughed about it, and I don't believe we ever really tried to hurt one another. Thank you.
That's a little bit from the novel, The Sweet Everlasting. You're listening to Judson Mitchum here on New Letters on the Air, and we're in Athens, Georgia, both Sabbath Creek and The Sweet Everlasting. In both of these novels, one of the issues that you deal with is the relationship between the races, between black and white. Both of your novels are set in Georgia in particular. I think you capture a variety of voices very well. And now that I know that you went to a predominantly black college, you must have made some lasting friendships there.
Changed my life going there. I had one of the most unusual experiences that anyone in this country has ever had, and that's an experience that will not be repeated. That is a good thing. I came out of segregation raised in segregation, went to segregated schools. Everything in Monroe was segregated. That's the way it was. Came to the University of Georgia and went here for 8 years. In the beginning, it wasn't completely segregated, but primarily. And by the end, there were more black students here and a couple of black faculty, a few. And then I went to Fort Valley State College and taught there for 30 years, where not only were the people I worked with black, but all the students were black, were African American. And I came to care for them, came to love them, came to love some of the people that I worked with. I had the experience of working for people who were different from me. I experienced the power differential, which is something that not many people have experienced to the extent that I experienced, and in such a stark fashion. The power differential, that is, my survival and the survival of my family depended upon my pleasing the people that I was working for. And they were better to me than they had to be, and really wonderful people. That's at the heart of both of the novels. Having had that experience is one that I'm very grateful for. You know, Keats talks about the veil of soul making, and the valley that I went to, Fort Valley, is a veil of soul making. To a large extent, made my soul and enabled me to deal with some of the issues that I'm trying to deal with. It's very hard for a white person to speak, just to speak about matters of race, and to have really a place to stand and a perspective and to speak with any authority. I could speak with some authority, but it's an authority born of a necessary humility. I don't want to be sitting up here saying how humble I am, but but there is a humility that follows from an experience like the one I had. And it is at the heart of what I'm trying to do, especially in fiction. It's harder to do in poetry. What I'm trying to do now, I'm trying to write a book that is so close to my life. John Berryman said, you should always be trying to do something that you don't think you can do, that you think is impossible for you to do. So I'm trying to write a book wherein the main character is a white man who, born in segregation, who goes to teach psychology at a predominantly black college, and trying to make that not me. And I've written it for several years now, and it's not me, and it's not that place. But I know that place well enough to know what might happen in a place like that, what might happen to a character like mine, what the voices might be like. None of the characters are identifiable. Some of the incidents are identifiable, but it's not that place.
I'm wondering if you've thought about writing memoir, or do you need that distance that fiction gives you in order to tell the story?
I can't remember well enough to write memoir. Not only that, I think the writing of memoir is, I think when you do that, you really take on a great responsibility to, as well as you can, tell it exactly the way it was. You always have questions of point of view, and you're always taking an angle on it, and it's always an interpretation. But I can't remember things that well, and when I do think I remember them, I can often find out that I've gotten it wrong, that I have turned it around. What I tend to see that I have done over time is to use my semantic memory rather than my episodic memory. Because I will remember the story that I have told. Once I've told the story, it's the story I remember. It's not the episode itself. Even once I've told the story, I create an episodic memory and visualize the story, and I think that I have seen it exactly as it happened. But it didn't happen that way. Nor do I remember things in detail enough to write memoir. But I do remember things well enough to remember the feeling and to remember the voices. I can remember the voices. And so I'm much more comfortable making things up.
You know, one of the things in The Sweet Everlasting, and I now think I get a sense of what feeds the Cutts family, which is the black family, and they're sharecroppers along with the white family that lives next door. And the main character in this novel is the son in the white family. And one of the things that I noticed that you did in your second novel called Sabbath Creek, it's got very different people. It's set in Georgia too, but not in the same town. The main character is a young boy, but he's being mentored by this old retired black baseball player,
Truman Stroud,
who's 93.
Yeah, Stroud runs this motel that I put in a fictional town called Sabbath Creek, which is down below Fitzgerald. There is a Sabbath Creek that runs through Macon, and I've always liked the name, but there's no town named that as far as I know. Truman Stroud is a character who had various incarnations. I wrote many, many pages about him where he was not this character and he became this character.
And this mother and son have gotten caught with their car broken down, and so they're in this old hotel that Stroud runs. Anyway, there's this passage where his niece is there with the young boy, Stroud's niece, who Stroud doesn't really get along with because she's a school teacher and very prim and proper and is always trying to put him in his place.
The woman with whom he's talking here, his niece, is based upon an English teacher. She went to Fort Valley.
One of the things that I absolutely love is that you brought the Cutts family in just a little tiny place in the book. It gave some insight into both novels and what you're trying to do. Do you mind if I get you to read that little passage in Sabbath Creek?
Sure. I love dealing with these voices.
You're listening to Judson Mitchum here on New Letters on the Air.
"You late," he yelled out. While she was still making her way across the kitchen linoleum, she didn't answer him. She had her eyes fixed on the next place she was about to step. As she came into the room, he repeated, "You late, 20 minutes late." She still didn't answer. When she reached the rocker, she turned and backed toward the chair, then dropped down into it. She sat down hard, and her dress slipped up above her knees, and she quickly pulled it down, then slid back in the chair. I told her Stroud had been talking about the book Satchel Paige had written on the old Jim Crow laws. "I didn't say it was a book he wrote. He kept a little notebook. That's all. He wrote it everywhere he went. He traveled all over the country back then, you see. And so he saw more of it than most black folk. Everywhere he went, he wrote down different laws he came across. That's all. I don't believe he ever did anything with it, though. If he did, I didn't hear about it. You know, I recall Ramona telling me about that notebook," Miss Young said. I asked Stroud if he could remember what was in it. He said he did remember a few things, but that he didn't like to think about it much. "Anyhow," he said, "don't me or her either one." He nodded at Miss Young. "Need a book to tell us how it was. We lived it every day. We could write our own book." "In your case," Miss Young said, "I suggest you read a book before you try writing one." "There she go," Stroud said. "Read a book. Maybe if she ever took something into the bedroom besides a book, somebody could stand to be in the same room with her. Read a book." I asked them not to start fighting, and Stroud said, "Was I fighting? I was going along talking. She jumped me. I wasn't fighting." Miss Young smiled at me. "I couldn't resist," she said. "What Uncle Truman said initially is correct, of course. No black person of a certain age needs a book to tell him or her about the injustices of segregation. That's the sad truth. But Joe," Stroud said, it was the only time I'd heard him call her by her first name, "you know, he had some real foolishness in that notebook. I forget what state it was in, but say a white man and a black man was fishing in the same boat, just the two of them. If noontime rolled around and they pulled out the sandwiches, by state law, they had to lay one of the fishing poles crossways across the boat to separate the front from the back. Otherwise, they'd be eating in the same place and they'd be breaking the law." Miss Young said, "Oh, it was wholesale ignorance." "And here's another one," Stroud said. "Here's another one. There was courtrooms that had one Bible for white folks to swear to tell the truth on and another Bible for black folk. The white Bible and the black Bible. Say a light-skinned man swore on the wrong Bible one time and the judge almost had a stroke." And then he held the witness in contempt of court and put him in jail. Miss Young said, oh yes, that practice of separate Bibles was very common. Leroy had whole lists of laws about who you couldn't marry. Just about every state he went in, and not just in the South, had laws like that. I don't even want to get started on that. Please don't, Miss Young said. Stroud and Miss Young both sat there looking at the floor. Miss Young here, suddenly Stroud was speaking in a voice I never heard. It groaned up from his chest and thickened. She lost a first cousin up at Yellow Shoals. Back in the days when white folks could do anything they wanted to a black person, Isaiah was a fine young man. Yes, he was, goodness, Isaiah cuts. And a pack of white men grabbed him and stripped his clothes off and whipped him and then blew the top of his head off with a shotgun for nothing, not a thing. He had done nothing at all, Lewis. But that didn't matter, not back then. What happened to the men who killed him, I asked. What happened? Stroud said, didn't nothing happen. That's the way it was. White men went on with their lives, died and went to heaven for all I know.
That's a little bit from Sabbath Creek, and we are with Judson Mitchum, the Poet Laureate of Georgia, here in Athens, Georgia. That's the mention of the Cutts family, which is very prominent in The Sweet Everlasting. You wouldn't need to read The Sweet Everlasting for that to be very poignant. And that turn that you make from all that humor to such a serious story in the end, it grabs you. You're very good at that. I'm curious, in the novel that you're working on now, are you going to have a little nut in there that we can find and will tie with these other two books?
Probably. I don't really know. I don't know what it's going to be. I mentioned this earlier. I didn't know I would ever write another novel, so I'm trying to write a novel that's a really, really hard thing to do, partly because I enjoy living in the novel, living in a world that allows me to go through the world looking at things to see if they fit with the fictional world, whether they will illuminate the fictional world that I'm working on. And so it could be that. For example, the usable, you never know what might be usable. I wanted to say that book that I mentioned that I attributed to Satchel Paige when he traveled around and wrote down all the Jim Crow laws, well, that's made up, but it's based upon a real book by a man named Stetson Kennedy. It's called The Jim Crow Guide. He wrote several books, but Stetson Kennedy, A Guide to Jim Crow, were written in, I think, 1959 or 60, where he detailed all of the Jim Crow laws. And that was an actual law, I forget where it was, but that if black men and white men were fishing in the boat, that when they came around to eating, they had to lay the fishing pole crossways across the boat. Idiocy like that, but that is given in great detail in that book. And I am using that book in the book that I'm trying to write now. And I'm doing a great deal of reading, trying to inform my perspective. As I said earlier, I think it's hard for a white person to have a place to stand, to have a perspective. And so I'm reading a lot. One book that I'm reading that I think is really extraordinary is a book by Kevin Young, who teaches at Emory, a book called The Gray Album. The subtitle is On the Blackness of Blackness. And I really think it's a wise book, and it's a wonderful book.
He's a great poet.
He is.
Another Kansan, just so you know.
Well, and also taught here. I'm also reading a novel that is sort of defeating me. It's by Paul Beatty. It's called The Sellout, and it's a satire. He's an African-American writer, and it's a hilarious book, but I don't quite know how to take it. And I suggest that if you're interested in this sort of thing, that you get it and that you read it and see if you can figure out how to deal with what he says in that book. It's really a really challenging book. The Sellout, reviewed in New York Times Book Review by Kevin Young.
This is New Letters on the Air, and we are here with Judson Mitchum. Does anybody have any questions?
So you've written about what the race dynamic is like in Georgia maybe 50 years ago, and how there were a lot of systems in place that oppressed Black Americans and that separated them from white Americans. And we've seen a lot in the news, you know, these surfacing videos of police brutality against Black Americans that indicates to us that we're not in a post-racial society and that there is still kind of this disconnect. So my question is, have you felt drawn at all to write about how the race dynamic might play out in America and specifically in the South in modern times?
Yes, I have thought a good bit about that. I don't know that I will be able to do that because there seems to be a certain latency between, a lot of delay in my work between the time when something happens and I'm able to write about it. But it is something that I talk about and that I think is very important. It's too easy to say that the society needs to change. The society is much healthier now than it was in 1960. Sometimes people are fond of saying, well, things are worse now or things haven't changed. No, things have changed a lot, a lot. But the idea that we would ever have been talking about a post-racial society is absurd. Of course we're not in a post-racial society, and how could we be? What I think, if I have to say one thing about this, is that the therapy that we need, and I don't know how we can get to it, but the therapy that white America needs is to try to achieve the double consciousness in an inverse way that W.E.B. Du Bois talked about with respect to what black people had to deal with in 1901 when he was writing this. He said, you have to, a black person, a Negro, as he would have said it, has to see himself not only through his own eyes, but he has to go around and look at himself through the eyes of a white person. And he has to do that as a matter of his own survival. It's not a matter of just seeing himself. How the white person sees him determines whether or not his children will survive, his family will survive. And it was a matter of terror. Well, I don't think that white people need to assume that degree of apprehension, but we need to go around and make that turn to be able to see ourselves through other eyes. And I know that's a really, really cliched thing to say, but it's a necessary thing to have happen. And that's one thing that art can do. It's one thing that especially I think fiction can do, is to put a person in the eyes of somebody else and bring the reader to see something from a different perspective. So I think with the writer, everything informs what you do, whether you write about it, address it directly or not. You take the news and you absorb it and take it and apply it to something else that you might be writing about another time.
Well, thank you very much. Let's give another round of applause to Judson Mitchell.
Thank you.
Recorded by WUGA at the Indigo Hotel in Athens, Georgia in 2015, Judson Mitchum read from his two novels, The Sweet Everlasting and Sabbath Creek, both winners of the Townsend Prize for Fiction. The other half of this interview, which features the Georgia Poet Laureate discussing and reading his poetry, is in our archives at newletters.org. There you can also find his colleague, Kevin Young, who's left Emory University in Georgia to become the director of New York Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture and the poetry editor of The New Yorker. Look for poems by both Kevin Young and Judson Mitchum in the Best American Poetry 2017. From New Letters Magazine at UMKC, today's show was produced with Danny Moran, Coy Duggar, Timothy Larrison, Abby Jamison, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.